Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Torah Teachers Roundtable. In fact, Tanakh edition, where we talk about the other books, and in particular of late, the histories of the northern and southern kingdoms at this point after they have conquered the land and then basically entered down the road of trying to lose it. And they're pretty well along at this point. We're looking at the book of 1 Kings, about chapter 20, and not quite the end, but close to the story of Ahab and his nasty, evil wife, Jezebel. But there's more to it. All right, so with that, we ended at about 2015. Let me go to you today, MP, and let you kind of take us through a brief recap and where we want to go next.
Okay. Well, brief recap. Ben-Hadad he's in the midst of he's getting a rebuke, okay? It's pretty common. It's even boilerplate in scripture. He says, you know what? If this authority does this or that to me, if I don't do such and so to you by umpty ump time tomorrow, something like that, right? He's issuing a threat. In this case, Ben-Hadad says he will turn Samaria to rubble and then crush the rubble to powder so fine that it'll be hard to pick up even a handful. You know, so Ahav replies in verse 11 is even better. He says there's a big difference between talking out your rump and actually pulling it off, Spanky. So that's basically where we were at in verse 13. Ahav and his associates see a bona fide prophet of Yehovah coming. And that's interesting. You know, they're fighting with Ben-Hadad, the Syrian king, and they're having their lunches handed to them. And along comes this prophet, and the prophet says, Yah's going to take care of this, you know. So that's where we're at, coming up to verse 15. So in verse 15, let's go ahead and read 15 through 18, and I'll comment on that.
Okay.
What's that?
I was going to say, let's say good afternoon to Rob, and good morning, early good morning to Rob, and let him go ahead and read it if he wants, and then we'll pick it up there.
Sure.
Okay, well, good morning, everybody, and it is early morning in beautiful Thailand. Paradise can't be seen because it's dark. But anyway.
Okay.
picking up where Mark Patron had just kind of discussed, according to custom, the fast day is supposed to be a time of self-searching and the correction of any sin or evil in a private or public life. And so in 1 Kings 21,
We're in chapter 20, Rob.
Oh, we're in 20? Okay, never mind. Let's go up to 20.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves too much. We'll upset MP again.
Okay, yeah. Okay, Ben-Hadad does boast. May the gods do terrible things to me and worse ones as well as there's enough dust in Shimron or Samaria to give each of my followers a handful. And Ahav, and I have to commend Ahav or Ahab. He seems to have grown a pair.
Yeah.
Because he's defiant. And he started out being very wet noodle-ish. But he tells Ben-Hadad, he who is putting on his armor shouldn't boast as if he were taking it off.
Exactly.
Which I like because it's poetic as well as defiant. It shows he's not just a brute, but he's a Renaissance man. And one should not boast that he who puts on the sword to wage war, for he doesn't know whether or not he will be victorious. His sword binding after he has come up from war victorious. Similarly, your master shouldn't boast about a future event is what Ahab is saying, but he's saying it in a poetic term. Now, Ahab's resistance was further encouraged by the prophet of Yahweh, who I believe is Micaiah, the son of Imlah.
I think it that's
pretty much a given, I think, but he's not actually named, so it's a guess too.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Midrash talks about it by name so much that you have to actually read the Hebrew and go, I think you're right. I don't think it's actually in there. But they certainly assume that's who it is.
Well, yes, and all the Midrashes are in agreement that it is Micaiah.
Yeah.
And that would make him one of the four disciples of Elijah. And he appeared before the king and told him not to be afraid of the overwhelming superiority of the besieging troops. So, on the very day, the prophet Micaiah promised Yahweh would deliver the enemy into his hands. So he would recognize that Israel's Elohim is Yahweh.
Right.
Who will defeat them? The answer, the young men who served the district governors. They are the hostages for all the princes of the other nations would give their children into the custody lest they rebel against Ben-Hadad. This was an ongoing way of doing business. Who'll start the fighting? The answer, you will. And Ahab, you go first, so you shall kill Ben-Hadad. Now, according to Shem Ephraim, the reading is, and you shall not wait, and you shall start the fighting. Now, Ahab counted the district governor's young men, and there were 232. And after that, he counted all the people, and all the people of Israel were 7,000. Now, Rashi says, I say that they are the ones concerning whom the scripture stated in 1 Kings 19:18, every knee that hasn't been down before Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him.
And I agree. Rashi's a pretty smart guy.
Well, yeah, normally he is. And, Even for a French Jew, but if it's not accurate, why would they count the number 7,000? I mean, there seems to be an interpolation there.
Well, in other words, exactly. What's the point of giving us the number if it wasn't supposed to be some kind of connection?
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's not like Yah didn't give that number to Eliyahu when he was in the cave. You know, that there are 7,000 people who haven't bowed the knee to Baal, and all of a sudden we see 7,000 people. So it makes sense to put the two together.
And it seems to tie in with how Shaul or Paul saw it. Because when he was given this passage, he's feeling sorry for himself. Yeshua says that, Yahweh says, don't you remember what I said to Elijah? Do I need to say that to you too? You know, that's and I think that's an interesting situation, that every time someone makes a hurling accusation of the spirituality of Israel, Yahweh always says, I have a whole group, a remnant, but right. A group that still worship me in spirit and in truth inside of Judaism. And I think that is amazing, especially during Shaul's time, because you would think the Christian would have you believe that Judaism has been rejected and Christianity has been accepted now, replacement theology, in other words, and that Yahweh has rejected, by and large, the Jew, and there is no remnant. But if Yahweh is setting a precedent here, he always has a remnant inside of covenant-keeping Israel that hasn't rejected the original faith.
Amen.
So I think, you know, that trying to say that Judaism has been replaced by Christianity is a by precedent standards is not true.
Well, that's I mean, we've talked about this before, but that's what I would call an outright heresy for a bunch of obvious reasons, including the fact that the Northern Kingdom, Israel, is still in exile for its whoring. And if we replaced, if Christianity replaced anything, it was the whoring that was being done in ancient Ephraim. So,
exactly.
You know, isn't it funny? Because, you know, there's nothing more intolerant than a smoker that's quit smoking.
Right.
And it's kind of funny that there's, that Ephraim is so intolerant of the Jews. You know, he suddenly finds out, oh, I'm Ephraim. I need to get back to the faith. But those Jews, now they got it wrong. They're bad.
Right.
They don't know what they're talking about. Their sages don't know what they're talking about. And you're like, you're the Johnny come lately. Why are you so intolerant?
Exactly.
And it's, if you read the prodigal son, that story, the prodigal is just happy to be home. You know?
Yep.
Judah naturally feels like, well, I kept the faith. Why don't I get a party? And the statement is, okay.
Well, the answer is obvious, too, because you were out whoring with the pigs, too, just a little bit later on. And Jeremiah 3 tells that story along with Ezekiel 23.
Yeah. And it's the statement to the older brother is, okay, you've stayed in my house and you've eaten from my table the whole time. So you've been having a party, whether you realized it or not, by just being in the house all the time and being at the table all the time. You know what?
You've been blessed nonstop. And my son had walked away and he's come back. Exactly.
Right. So, you know, do you count your experience as nothing comparable to a one day party? And then Mark Call has a good, point that's part of the older brother. Wasn't true. You know, he went whoring too. But
he just came home every night.
Right. A remnant stayed true. So it's, you know, it's a complicated situation. Yahweh is in a complicated relationship. So I think that's a given.
Well, so we were going to read on, right? Let's go ahead and continue. You want to read it? You want me to?
Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start in 2015.
Do 15 through 18, and then let me talk for a little bit, and then you guys can have it back.
At that moment, a prophet approached Achab, king of Israel, and said, "Here's what Yahweh says. Have you seen this vast army? I'm going to give you a victory over them today. Then you'll know that I'm Yahweh." And Achav asked, "Who will defeat them?" He answered, "That's what Yahweh says, the young man who served the district governors." He said, "Who will start the fighting?" And he answered, "You will." And he counted the district governor's young men, and there were 232, and then he counted all the people of Israel, and they were 7,000. They set out at noon. Ben-Hadad was drinking himself senseless in the field barracks that they had made for themselves because of the sun. And he and the kings, the 32 kings who were his allies, the district governor's men, went out first. Ben-Hadad sent for information, and they reported, "Men have come out from Shimron," he said. "Whether they have come out for peace or for war, take them alive." So the district governor's men left the city, followed by the army, and each one killed his man. Aram fled, and Israel pursued them. Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, escaped on horseback with some of the cavalry. And the king of Israel went out and attacked the horses and the chariots, inflicting a massive defeat on Aram.
All right. Wow. Well, verse 15 talks about the 7,000 people of Israel, which just happens to be the number of those Israelites that had not bowed the knee to Baal. We talked about that already. So Ahav led the 7,000 faithful men of Israel who did not worship Baal and the 732 sons of the provincial kings into battle at noon, the heat of the day, against the combined might of Ben-Hadad and his 32, verse 16 says, gives us that number, sublords. Now, Ahav and his 7,232 Israelites came out at noon when Ben-Hadad, his generals, and presumably his army, were three sheets to the wind, stupid drunk. And I seriously doubt that there were many who could even walk, much less wield a sword in anything like adequate defense of their own lives, much less useful in a pitched battle. TSK has a pretty tough diatribe on the sin of drunkenness in general, and especially in a battlefield situation. I'm going to go ahead and read that, and then I'll come back to you. It says, now the Syrians, the besiegers, had their directions from a drunken king who gave orders over his cups while they were drinking at noon. Drunkenness is a sin, this is TSK speaking in generalities now, which is most detestable in all, but more so in a king than in a private individual, inasmuch as the greater weight of man's situation carries, whether from accumulated riches, family connections, heredity, authority, whatever, so is the influence which his vices must have on those around him. Now, perhaps it may be said from past experience that drunkenness, which is a most heinous sin in the sight of God, this again, this is TSK speaking, these are late 19th century theologians, okay, Christian theologians. Okay,
so precursors.
Yes, so may eventually lead them into drunkenness, for they shut their eyes against the most palpable facts, and rather than give up the paltry gratification of the debauch, involve thousands by their example to positive harm. Okay, I can see the argument there. These drunken leaders are leading their minions into the same kind of thing. So anyway, drinking an occasional beer, by the way, or a glass of wine, is by no means sinful. But allowing oneself to be given over to the drunkenness is, and is very unwise, as Ben-Hadad is about to be taught. Okay, Ben-Hadad's orders were obviously those of a drunken man, because the second part makes absolutely no sense. Here's what it says in the KJV. It says, whether they be come out for peace, take them alive, or whether they come out for war, take them alive.
All right, let me, if
what?
I may, go
what
ahead
the heck is that all about?
Finish your point, but I want to make a comment on here, because there is some really interesting midrash on this score for sure.
Yes. Lay it on me, man.
Okay, well, it goes like this, and it goes, it's a counterpoint, I guess, to the, all of this happened because they were screaming drunk. Basically, yes, they were drinking, but basically what he says here is, look, I don't care whether they come out to make war or whether they come out to make peace, take them alive. Why? And you've asked the question already. Ultimately, one of the commentaries that I found quite compelling says, look, these guys are slouches. We got nothing to worry about from these guys here. We're going to kick butt and take names. And basically, what that means is, just wrap them up. Here we are all drinking ourselves silly because we're not the least bit worried about what they can do to us. He does not understand clearly that there is a creator of the universe at work here, and that there's more going on. So I guess the bottom line to my mind is this is talking about extreme cockiness, and it's the cockiness that reflects in the drunkenness, not the other way around. This guy doesn't think that he has anything to worry about here, and he could care less. And you know what they say, pride goeth before a fall, and it's going to happen. Go ahead, MP. Mark? Do we lose him?
And it goes to say that...
I had my mic off, sorry.
Oh,
Well, yeah, if they're coming out for war, take them alive. If they're coming out for peace, take them alive. It's a ridiculous situation. Okay, that doesn't make any sense.
How many of the Syrian
troops are going to have to die before there was any time to send for clarification for that ridiculous order? You know, these guys have what?
I don't know how much of what I was saying you heard, Mark, but the counterpoint
was. I heard it.
Okay.
And you were right, and I'm just agreeing with you, but. I'm ready to go to the next four verses, but I want to let you guys in on it.
Okay.
Well, I think one thing I would say, I'm not a military man, and so I don't understand why Ben-Hadad gives this crazy order. It doesn't seem to make sense. But he does give the order, and he can't really be challenged.
Exactly.
The monarch was absolute monarchy, and it does tie in with the rest of his behavior. He's been very, very cocky. He's talked trash the whole time. He feels very confident in his ability to beat Israel. And he's not used to losing, and I think that's been his downfall.
Yeah, doesn't think it's going to happen here for sure.
Yeah, and he's been so successful that he doesn't feel in danger, and he certainly doesn't feel in danger spiritually. So he doesn't respect the Elohim of Israel. So. I think this is, and the whole point of Israel winning is not because Israel's righteous. It's to prove a point that Yahweh is the Elohim and there is none besides him.
All right.
For his namesake, he will hand the victory over to Israel.
And see if they get it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left. MP, anything else? Let's go ahead and let's read at least the next couple of verses before the music comes up here. All right. Well, I'll go ahead and read them. I think Mark maybe has muted his microphone again. So it says, meanwhile, right. Those had gone out from the city, the youths of the officers of the states and the army that was after them. So, essentially, these are not what you'd call seasoned troops at this point. And Ben-Hadad may have a point in expecting, oh, they're gonna mop them up and take them all captive. They smote each one his opponent. What? So these unseasoned green guys basically kicked butt and took names on their opponent. Kind of think of a man-to-man defense, I guess, and they whacked
exactly.
them. Aram fled, and Israel chased them. Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, escaped on a horse with horsemen. Isn't it interesting? They even feel the need to put king of Aram in there, almost like the creator's rubbing it in. He is, in fact, the master of war. He escaped on a horse with horsemen. The king of Israel went out and smote the horses and the chariots, and he dealt Aram a great blow. MP, less than a minute. Take us out.
Okay. Well, it certainly looks as though the field commanders among the Syrians executed Ben-Hadad's orders to the letter. So the ostensibly least trustworthy of Ahab's military leaders brooked no quarter to the Syrian troops and had their own troops wipe them out, while Ben-Hadad took to the hills on horseback, in verse 20, with his retinue following to take arrows in their own backs to protect his. It looks to be as methodical and well-planned a campaign as any before or since.
All right, and that takes us to the break. We'll be back after this.
Don't break me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday either love turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to see. Children will pay. One day, one day, one day.
Welcome back now to the second half, the first hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition and 1 Kings chapter 20, where when we went to break, we had the cocky king of Aram, Ben-Hadad, who basically gets drunk and thinks this is going to be such a pushover. He'll send out the junior varsity squad and take everybody captive, and it turns out he's wrong. We were about in the middle of that. We interrupted MP. So, Mark, go ahead and pick it up where you wanted to go.
Okay. It really and truly looks like the field commanders for the Syrians actually did exactly what they were told. They tried to take everybody alive, which doesn't make any sense. So the ostensibly the least trustworthy of Ahab's military leaders, the 232 young men who were the princes of the provinces that he had taken over. Okay, these were guys who were sent as hostages, all right, and he's using them because Yehovah told him to through the prophet. Okay, so anyway, these 232 guys brooked no quarter to the Syrian troops, and they had their own troops wipe them out. Well, Ben-Hadad took to the hills on horseback, like I said just before we left, with his retinue following to take the arrows in their backs instead of his. So it looks to be a methodical and well-planned campaign as any before or since. And it was, since the plan of battle was revealed to Ahab by the prophet of Yehovah, Mikiyahu. The Syrian defeat is a precursor of what will come in just a few more chapters. We'll see in 2 Kings 7, 6 through 7, it'll say this. And Yehovah had made the host of the Syrians to hear the noise of chariots and a noise of horses and a noise of a great host. And they said one to another, lo, the king of Israel hath hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. Wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their asses, even the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. Okay, it's exactly the same kind of thing as is happening right here. The Syrians must have been famous for turning tail and running at the drop of a hat, since the implication is that Ben-Hadad did exactly the same in this event. They had no time to pack up the camp before fleeing to save their worthless lives. Okay, they left all the tents and all of the food and everything that they... Okay, so it was then, in verse 21, that Ahab came out to do the work that Yehonatan's armor bearer did. Okay. In, 1 Samuel 14, 13 through 15 says this. And Yehonatan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet and his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Yehonatan and his armor bearer slew after him. And that first slaughter, which Yehonatan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within a half acre of land. And there was trembling in the host in the field and among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers, they all trembled and the earth quaked. So it was a very great trembling. The feeling in Ben-Hadad's army was very similar to that of the host that Yehonathan had defeated. It was the fear of Yehovah first inspired in the Syrians by the 232 princes of the provinces, not even ethnic Israelis, whether the Syrian host knew it or not. In verse 22, the prophet gives Ahab another word from Yehovah, which with the prophecy of things to come, fairly soon at the beginning of the king's year of business, early spring probably. So Ahab has an approximate time frame of when Syria will come again. He has about 5 to 6 months to build adequate defenses and build up his troops' abilities and attitudes to meet the next challenge from Ben-Hadad. And we'll discuss the Syrians' plans in a bit. That's okay. What I got through verse 22.
All right. Rob, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah. So, with all of that said, what's going on? What's going on with Syria? What's going on with Israel? What I think is interesting is that Yahweh's name has been vindicated. Ben-Hadad shouldn't have lost.
Absolutely.
One thing that always struck me up until today is that in a siege, it appears that the Arab falters, whether it's in Desert Storm, whether it's the siege of Baghdad, whether it's the Six-Day War. They don't like a full-blown attack, a frontal attack. It seems to rout them. And
yes.
I think that there's something there. I'm not sure what it is, but I think there's something there. If as a people, do they not like confrontation? Because they much rather prefer guerrilla warfare. And in our mind, in the Western mind, that's considered bad form.
Right.
If you cannot meet your opponent in battle in a sporting way, you're considered a non-honorable people. And I think there's something there. I really do. I think that it shows that they're not an honorable people.
I think you're right.
Anyway.
I think you're absolutely right. They love to attack from behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they love to attack from a distance. So that their own worthless lives are not at stake. That's very much, very, very correct, I think. And the Western armies see it as cowardly.
Yes. And dishonorable.
Right.
You know, we can laugh at the old way of, the way that the armies used to, fight a war in the West, you know, lining up and moving like pieces on a chessboard.
Right.
But there's, again, something to be said about that. We never have, as a people, wanted to reduce war to its savage form. And when it gets savage, that bothers us. And we see that in Vietnam and even in the Middle East with ISIS. But we can meet the challenge. It just dislocates our thinking for a moment.
It rankles.
And so now, you know, the left is always fond of saying that we lost in Vietnam. We didn't lose in Vietnam. We won the Tet Offensive. We left having won. And when we left, the South couldn't support itself. And so they lost. But we didn't lose, and that needs to be clear. We won the Tet Offensive, and just because Walter Cronkite said we lost the war doesn't mean it was so. We won the police action we were sent to do, and then we left when it was no longer to our interest. In our best interest to stay. We went there not as fighting our war. We went there as a police action for the UN, holding up a coalition of forces from Australia and France.
Very, very similar to the Korean War, but
Yes. But it's, that's lost. And it's considered an American war, and it's not an American war. It was a police action of the UN, and we went there, and we did our objective, and that was to prop up the monarchy of South Vietnam until it couldn't be propped up anymore. We were losing too many of our soldiers in a police action, and it was unpopular. And so we had to finally serve our own best interest and leave. Anyway, my point was, guerrilla warfare we can do it, but we find it dishonorable to do.
Right.
But we can be successful in doing so and in fighting that kind of warfare too.
Absolutely. We can do that with the best of them.
Sure. It's just that we need to know that's what we're going in for, and that's what we did in Syria, and we proved successful in Syria. So I think that it's important for us to see this in Ben-Hadad's army, that when it was a frontal attack, they seemed to crumble. Now, it's true that they're drunk. But they don't even try to mount up a counterattack. They run, which is unusual. You'd think that some part of the army would have said, wait a minute, they're attacking. Let us counterattack. But they don't. To a man, they run. And this makes a strong statement. Now, If you bring it into today, it appears that's what happened when ISIS started encroaching from Iraq into Syria. They seem to have crumbled, their army crumbled, and gave them ground. And it was only after the Soviet Union came in that they were able to mount a counterattack and start pushing back on ISIS.
Right.
We came in. Now, we can be accused of actually creating ISIS.
Yeah.
Absolutely we can.
Because, in fact, they did.
As a matter of fact, the Obama-Clinton regime created ISIS big time.
Well, armed them, funded them, trained them.
Actually, and this can be well documented, John McCain
was... Is this a distinction without a cause? Isn't John McCain one of Obama's lieutenants? I mean, seriously. I wish I was joking about that, but I don't think that's a funny matter.
No, but it was his... if you remember, he went over there and spent a great deal of time he was supposed to find out what rebels we could support. And he came back with this coalition of rebels that he called a volunteer army. But in actuality, it was the ISIS caliphate.
That's right.
And whether he understood that or not is immaterial. He was used.
I know he did. Okay. I know in my mind that he did. Okay. Well, that guy was anything but a hero.
All right. Well, I tend to agree with all of that. I do have to ask the question, where are we headed with this and with respect to the story of Ben-Hadad? Because I got to admit, Ben-Hadad seems like a more honorable guy to me than some of the people we're now talking about.
Well, it does. And I'm actually likening Ben-Hadad to the Syrian army of today, not to ISIS.
Right.
I see the coalition of Israel more like the coalition of America and these rebels, because that's basically what Israel does. These young men are not pro-Syrian forces. At the opportune time, they rebel and kill their own hand-to-hand combat. They kill their opponent. But they're not, they can't be trusted either. They're not pro-Israel. They're just pro themselves. They're being, they're liberating themselves.
Exactly.
And so this will prove later an undoing of Israel, because they do begin to lean heavily on their allies that they think they're making that they're not really making. The people that are allying themselves with Israel are only doing that as a pragmatist point of view, and then later we'll see everyone turn on Israel and support Assyria, the Assyrian invasion.
Yes.
Hearkening to our own situation as a people. Look at when we, everyone turned on us in the Middle East, and we are the only ally we really can count on is Israel.
In the Middle East, yes, you're right.
Yes. Well, we can't even count on Britain in the Middle East. They get weird about the Middle East.
We really can't count on Britain for much of anything.
Well, they know they messed up. They know they messed up all the way from Lawrence of Arabia down to the partition of the Middle East with forming Iraq.
Yes.
Irrationally. It's three countries, and they try to make it one country. They right. should have made Kurdistan. That's what Assyria is.
Right.
And then Babylonia for the Sunnis. And then Uruk, or Ur, for the Shias.
Right.
It, now that's the demarcation. But anciently, it's the Assyrians, Babylonians, and Sumerians.
Correct.
They have always, there's always been a distinct three people. And they think differently. They're not cohesive. And it takes a strong man to keep them all together.
Exactly. And, which is why we should never have taken out Saddam Hussein without having somebody to take his place. At least as wicked.
Well, wicked as he may be, but he was our wicked guy. We put him in there.
Exactly.
Again, we're schizophrenic. We don't take care of our own. We turn on them when they turn out to be bad guys. Well, we knew they were bad guys. That's what we put them in there for.
Yeah, but it became common knowledge that they're bad guys. That's why they had to go.
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway,
go back to
23, yeah. 25.
Okay, sometimes I got to play herd here and say, okay, there's something that's got to do with the story in there somewhere, but I'm honestly not sure where.
Well, your experience with the goats help you in the herding aspect.
Okay, that's true. Well, goats are easier to herd than cats, I've been told.
Yeah, all you have to do is put some out there for them to eat and they'll flock to it. But
okay.
Anyway, it could be a tire. It doesn't have to be food. It can be an old tire, for goodness sake.
Yeah. Oh, they love tires. They'll climb on that. All right. Well, yep. In any case.
Okay. So Ben-Hadad has retreated. He's fled. He's running. And Israel is chasing him. And right now we can cue the Benny Hill music. But anyway, they're going along, and so the two uneven armies will meet again on the plain of Aphek.
Soon.
You want to read that? We haven't read that part yet, I don't think.
Well, let's see. No, we haven't, and I'm not even sure. I guess
23 to 25 is where we need to be next.
Yeah, because we just skipped over an entire year. So I think I want to make sure before we continue that we note that there was a prophetic warning. Look, you're going to come back again. You got a year, and strengthen yourself, the prophet says, and know what you will do. For at the end of the year, he's going to come back again. And essentially, yeah. This is where the Midrash, and I think in general, it's not difficult to realize, look, you didn't beat him the first time with the strength of your seasoned soldiers. You beat him because the Creator was on your team. So maybe when it says strengthen yourself, he's talking about a spiritual level of strengthening. All right, so verse 23 to 25 says, the servants of the king of Aram said to him, their God is God of the mountains. That's why they were stronger than us. But we'll fight them on the plain. Yeah, that's the ticket. Then we will surely be stronger than them. This is what you should do. Remove each king from his place, put governors in their stead, count soldiers like the soldiers of yours that fell, and horses like the horses, and chariots like the chariots. We'll fight them on the plain, and we will surely be stronger than them. And the king listened to their voice and did accordingly. Now, the Midrash here, I'll make just one comment, and I think it's fairly clear and not that difficult. These are idolaters, and they see the God of Israel as another one of these bogus gods, like exactly. So many of the other idols. So, hey, you know, he is limited in scope. This must be the mountain god. Well, we'll do it in a different place. Ha, ha, ha. And we got him. All right.
Exactly.
Go ahead, MP.
That's how I open in this, in the pantheistic attitude of most of the nations of the earth. Gods are gods over certain things, like wine or music,
yeah, yeah.
War.
Yeah.
The heathen do not believe that there is one, but one Yehovah who controls all. The gods of the heathen are local or confined to their own spheres, even though many do believe that there is one god who dictates to all the rest, such as Odin in Norse mythology or Jove in Anglo-Saxon. Yehovah is not such a demigod. Yehovah is almighty over everything, even those so-called gods and their supposed spheres of influence. He is in utter control of all, and all will work together by his plan to his ends. Now, we may or may not personally see it, but that is the truth that you can bet the farm on. Treasure Scripture Knowledge has this short note on the heathen idea of gods. It says, it was the general belief in the heathen world that each district has its tutelary and protecting deity who could do nothing outside of his own province.
Yeah.
Of course, that province might be geographical or environmental, but usually not both. People are very religious, all of us, even those who profess atheism. There are no atheists, in foxholes, though. So Ben-Hadad's servants came to him in verses 23 and 24 with a false belief that Yehovah was a god of hills, which explained to them why Yehovah overcame them in the hills. But if they could get Israel to fight in the valleys or the plains, they and their gods would definitely defeat Israel. They were so sure of this that they counseled that the 32 vassal kings not even go into battle, but their generals, chiefs of staff, should lead their armies into battle. I think it's likely that Ben-Hadad's counselors just happened to be the vassal kings. I wouldn't be surprised. Let somebody else go in and die. Now, I don't think Ben-Hadad was very bright because he took this advice and implemented it immediately, including, in verse 25, sending out the same number of troops Israel had wiped out before. Look at what they actually said to Ben-Hadad while they counseled him. This is a marked paraphrase. They said, send out another army the same size and power as the one you just lost. You bet Tim the Toolman Taylor, your best Tim the Toolman Taylor impression. What? Huh? You know, why would they remind him of the defeat he just endured? Anyway, and they fight him in the coastal plain, or rather in the, this is going to be in the plain of the Yarden, where Yehovah has no power, but our gods do, they said. I'm sure that they put as encouraging a tone as they could to sell this brilliant stratagem to him. And he swallowed the bait, hook, line, and sinker as well. As I said, the guy was just not too bright. That's what I got, 22 to 25.
Okay.
And I'm sure that you guys have got some. Oh, we're near the end.
I was going to say, I would go to Rob, but I still a little bit gun-shy on that score because we got less than 30 seconds. So let me go ahead and read the next verse. So it was at the end of the year, Ben-Hadad mustered Aram and went up to Aphek for war with Israel. And we'll come back and pick it up there after the top of the hour. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. I know welcome back now to the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition, second hour, and we're still talking about the chapter where there is a big series of wars, or battles at least, between the king of Aram, Ben-Hadad, and good old, well, not so good, but better than he was, King Ahab at this point. And when we went to break, we were just talking about chapter 20, verses 26 and 27, where it's the end of that year that the kingdom of Ahab, the southern kingdom of Judah, was given to prepare, and they basically blew it. The children of Israel mustered and provided for, and they went to meet them in battle. So go ahead and give us your comments on that, Rob, and we'll continue. And I think I misspoke. Did I say Judah anyway? Because Ahab is in the north.
Yeah, Israel. Okay. Afterwards, the prophet approached the king of Israel and said to him, "Go regroup your forces and think carefully what to do. For next year at this time, at the time of the end of the year, the king of Aram will renew his attack." Meanwhile, the servants of the king of Aram said to him, "Their Elohim is an Elohim of the hills or the mountains. That's why they were stronger than we were. But if we fight them on level ground, we will certainly be stronger than they are. Also do this, remove all the kings from their commands and put professional officers in their place. Since they're not of high-born family, they will endeavor to exert themselves in order to find favor. Then recruit an army as big as the army you lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot. We will attack them on the level ground, and we will certainly be stronger than they." And he heeded what they said and acted accordingly. So later, the prophet Micaiah returned and counseled, "Go regroup your forces and think carefully what to do, for next year at this time the king of Aram will renew his attack." A year later, Ben-Hadad returned, seeking revenge for his shameful defeat. This time he avoided battle in the mountains because his astrologers had counseled him that the Elohim of Israel was a god of the mountains and could be defeated only in the plains. Now, in 1 Kings 20:26, it says, "At the same time, the following year, Ben-Hadad mustered the army of Aram and went up to Aphek to attack Israel. The army of Israel, already mobilized and supplied, provided with supplies for war, they armed themselves with weapons and all the necessities of war, went to meet them, but the army of Israel encamped opposite them and looked like two herds of goats, while Aram filled the land." Now you can imagine what's going on here. Israel is in two camps that can be easily demarcated. And Ben-Hadad's army is flowing into the valley very liquid. So it must have been an awesome sight. So the two uneven armies met in the plain of Aphek, in the face of the vast Syrian host. The Hebrew army appeared like two flocks of kids, which Menachem, in his commentary, classifies this with an expression of revelation, that much like in Isaiah 47:2, "Uncover your locks." The expression of revelation fits with the flocks of goat, like Song of Songs 4:1, who bared Mount Gilead. When they came down from the mountains, it was bared or revealed. The situation seemed hopeless for Israel. They were exposed, but once again, Micaiah, the man of Yahweh, came to Ahab and told him not to worry. At this point, the man of Elohim approached and said to the king of Israel, "Here is what Yahweh says. Because Aram said that Yahweh is Eloha of the hills, but not Eloha Elohi of the valleys, I will hand over to you this entire huge army. Then you'll know that I am Yahweh. So what Mikiyahu is saying is, because that they have made this statement against Yahweh, Yahweh must bring the victory on his terms to vindicate that he's not just a territorial God. Where they're getting this is El Shaddai, or Shaddai, is one of the titles of the Elohim of Israel, as we all know. And El Shaddai is conventionally translated Almighty, the Almighty. However, in the Akkadian language, Shaddu means mountains, and Shaddau means mountain dweller, one of the names of Baal Amaru. So the Magi of Aram, they interpreted this, that he was only a deity of the mountains, and advised that Yahweh was God only in the mountains. So get the Israelites into the valley and Yahweh would be powerless. Then Aram will have the victory and Aram will know that Baal is Elohim. Well, that didn't work very well for him at this point.
No, it didn't.
Now, Rabbi Yohanan says every place where it states, and he said, must be expounded. The first saying refers to what he said to him, I'll deliver all this great multitude in your hand. The second, and he said, alludes to the admonition that if Ben-Hadad falls into your hand, show him no clemency. Therefore, when he took pity on him, he said to him in verse 42, since you released the man, I have designated you for destruction. So this is what the rabbis see. Anytime there is an unusual grammar used, the rabbis always look deeper. What's going on? And in this case, because he said, and he said twice, that there's something going on here, that he better had listened to what the instructions were and follow it to the T. And because Achav will not follow it to a T, as we'll see at the end of this chapter, then he signed his own death warrant. And I think that's interesting. Well, that brings us to verse 29 anyway.
Okay. MP, anything else on that?
We last saw Ben-Hadad about 6 months before, shortly after having been soundly defeated by Ahab and about 7,232 Israelites of Shomron. Afek is about 2 or 3 miles east of the Sea of Galilee, definitely on the plain and not in the hills or mountains of Bashan or Gilead. Now, Ben-Hadad is working according to the plan of verses 23 to 25. The vassal kings were removed from their places at the head of their armies and replaced with commanders, from the Hebrew to paka, which means to rule local areas. So Ben-Hadad's numbered the Syrians. But we are not told exactly how many troops they fielded in this little excursion. In verse 27, we are told that Israel was greatly outnumbered. Perhaps they had no more men than they had in verses 23 to 25, the same 7,232 men of war that had defeated Ben-Hadad in the last battle. Stone's Tanakh says just that in a note. It says on the note on verse on chapter 20 and verse 27, it says, compares the two armies. The Aramean force was immense, while its Israeli counterpart consisted of two paltry groups, the 272 sons of the vassals to Ahav and the 7,000 faithful Israelis. That's the end of the quote there. Now, but who would walk into the Israeli camp and right up to Ahab in verse 28 than the prophet who came to him in Shomron 6 months before? Remember that the prophet had given Ahab unusual but good advice on how to defeat a vastly superior Syrian army then. So perhaps the king had left orders standing that the prophet Micaiah or Mikiyahu was always welcome at the king's councils. So the prophet basically told Ahab that Yehovah had heard that the counselors of Ben-Hadad said when they were, and that the reason that they lost was that Yehovah was the Elohim of hills, but their Elohim were of the plains. Yehovah is going to disabuse them of that bit of folly and deliver this overwhelming array of troops into Ahab's hands. And Ahab was pleased as punch. Yehovah had come to Israel's aid during the last business cycle, so let's trust him again. Now, the business cycle is the cycle of war in the springtime, spring and summer. So now Yehovah's purpose in this is to turn Israel's heart to him. But Ahab doesn't seem to get it, as we'll see in a little bit. Zamra says this about it. It says, through a series of miraculous deliveries, God proved that Aramean military might was nothing in the face of Torah spirit. To disabuse the Arameans of their illusion that the God of Israel had power only in the hills, he lured them out to the valleys where Israel smote 100,000 of them in one day, alluding to the destruction of a complete array of the 10 sephirot of impurity, each consisting of subarrays and sub-subarrays. Zamra is obviously heavily into Kabbalistic kind of stuff, and they're talking about the Tree of Sephirot, and that there isn't just the one that deals with Yehovah himself, but there's also the ones that deal with all of the other false deities, and so 100,000 of them in one day, corresponding to the number of gods that were out there with them. That's what Azamra is talking about. And I'm good through verse 29.
Okay. So let me make one other comment here. Rob already mentioned that a lot of times when there's some interesting grammar or unusual constructions in the Hebrew, there's a lot of times the sages will say, hey, there's more to this than meets the eye. One of those cases is where in these verses we just finished reading, the prophet says, Ve'amar, and he said twice. As mm-hmm. if, and there are two separate things that are being described. And essentially, the claim goes, those two separate things are, A, you're going to win. And B, when you finally capture Ben-Hadad, you're not to let him go. You're going to kill him. And it's not the first time we've heard
right.
an instruction like that either.
No. But he does exactly what Shaul does, is he tries to out mercy Yahweh, and
yeah.
that gets in trouble when you don't follow the battle instructions. It costs you in time and money, and in life. In this case, it's going to cost him his own life. So
exactly.
Going back to the 29th verse. They remained in the camp opposite each other for 7 days. On the seventh day, the battle began, and the people of Israel killed 100,000 soldiers of Aram in a single day. The rest fled to Aphek into the city, and the wall fell on 27,000 of the men who were left. Ben-Hadad fled into the city and took refuge in an inside room. His servant said to him, "Hear now, we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. If it's all right with you, let's put on sackcloth around our waists and ropes on our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Maybe he'll spare your life." So they put sackcloth around their waists and ropes on their heads, and they went to the king of Israel and said, "Your servant Ben-Hadad says, please spare my life." And he answered, he still is alive, and he's my brother." The men took this as a promising indication and seized on it to say, "Yes, Ben-Hadad is your brother." Then Ahab said, "Go and bring him here." Ben-Hadad went out to him, and Ahab had him climb up into his chariot. Ben-Hadad said to him, "I'll return the cities my father took from your father. Also, you can set up markets for trade in Damascus, or Damascus, as my father did in Shimron. If you put this covenant in writing," says Ahab, "I will set you free." So he made a covenant with him and set him free. So for 6 days, the army faced each other in silence. But on the seventh day, they clashed. The Syrian troops were completely vanquished. 100,000 Syrians were slain in battle, and Ben-Hadad fled to the town of Aphek to rally the rest of his men and to decide what to do. His followers advised him to dress in sackcloth and put on ashes on his head and go to King Ahab to ask for forgiveness. "Here now, we have heard that the king of the house of Israel is a merciful king." So Ben-Hadad listened to their advice and humbly begged Ahab to spare his life. And this is something for him. But remember, he's a trash-talking dude. So for him to humble himself or humiliate himself is something. Achab was moved by the humility of the mighty king of Syria. He made a treaty of mutual friendship and brotherhood with him and set him free. After he had promised to return all the cities his father had taken away from Omri, Achab's father and the people of Israel said, since words of peace fell from his mouth, even inadvertently, it's a good sign. And they hastened to confirm the covenant. Ben-Hadad said to him, I will return the cities my father took from your father. The cities that my father took from your father, Omri, I'll return to you. And you can set up markets for trade in Damascus or Damascus. So you can set up a trade market in Damascus and have influence there, although it is the capital of my kingdom. These traders would act as lobbyists for Israel in Aram, as my father did in Shimron. Shimron, your city, my father set up basically an embassy, even against your father's will, and he was saying all this out of fear. If you put this covenant in writing, says Achab, I'll set you free. So he made a covenant with him and set him free. Said Achab to him, and I will, with this treaty, release you. So this is a mutual beneficial treaty, is the way Israel sees this, that this was more important than inflicting a lasting blow to Syria, which would have taken years for them to get over.
Oh, yeah.
And there would have been peace while they had to rebuild an army and rebuild armaments and things like that, and certainly figure out who was going to be the next strong man. But instead, they leave the battlefield intact, having made peace. Now they can regroup and refortify.
Right.
And
that's what Yah did not want them to do.
Right.
And that's what...
If you look at it from a strategic situation, what Yahweh said would have brought peace at least for 7 years. But instead, Achab misses the mark, which will be the undoing of Israel. In other words,
exactly,
this sowing the seeds later for the Assyrian invasion. And though Achab sees himself as winning an ally, he hasn't. He hasn't won any ally. He only has let a person stay alive that hates your guts and will eventually chime in with your enemies to destroy your country.
That's right.
And by the way, I guess I ought to mention it because I figured Rob probably would. There's a rabbinic saying, and it's got a number of variations, but it basically goes like something like, he who is merciful to the cruel will be cruel to the merciful, or similar. And that's essentially, this is one of the places that is cited as an example of precisely what that means and what the pitfalls are.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Let me hit on those verses here.
All right.
Okay. So in verses 30 to 34, 100,000 Syrians died on the battlefield, while the rest fled to the city of Afek. Now, it doesn't say this in Scripture, but in my mind, it has the remaining Syrian soldiers taking refuge from the midday sun under the shadow of the city's hills. It doesn't say that, but that's the way I'm thinking about it. So they had just seen the greatest part of their army destroyed by a relatively small number of Israelis, and the fear of Yehovah entering into them, so that they could actually run headlong toward the city of Afek, only to have the city's wall fall on another 27,000 Syrian soldiers, killing them. What else would happen? Azamra, again, says this. After the survivors fled to Afek, which is a few kilometers east of the southern tongue of the Kinneret at Lake Tiberias, collapsing fortifications killed another 27,000, corresponding to the 22 basic letters of the Hebrew alphabet, together with the five final letters, okay, a total of 27, each of which contains its own arrays and subarrays of the 10 Sephirot. Okay, so they're talking about the Kabbalistic aspects of the Gematria. So up to verse 30, we have no idea how many Syrians are left to fight, only that they had lost 127,000 in about an hour or so. The way KJV reads, it looks as though Ben-Hadad was frightened by the wall, fortifications falling on his men, so it only makes sense to close himself into a room with at least four walls and a ceiling that would fall on him. The words KJV translates as inner chamber are cheder bechader, okay, which is a chamber within a chamber. Now, I don't know what Ben-Hadad is thinking, but he ran away from the destruction of 27,000 men by being crushed under walls of fortification into a room within a room so that the four outer walls could fall on and crush the four inner walls that he was using for protection from walls falling on him. The logic eludes me. I think he's thoroughly and thoroughly shaken and just isn't thinking in the moment. He is scared. And that's Hiljack for scared spitless. Now in verse 31, Ben-Hadad's servants, not the senior staffers who led the armies into battle that day, all of whom were presumably wiped out, but his actual household servants, his avadim, approached him and spoke wise words to him, which is, it seems he hearkened to. Excuse me. They proposed that day that they, rather, his household staff, intercede for him to Ahab. They would dress as if in mourning and humility and bring Ben-Hadad's plea to Ahab. What's the worst that could happen? They all die? Isn't that what was going to happen to them anyway if Ahab is like the other kings? It looks as though Ben-Hadad was about catatonic because he didn't even give them an okay. They just did it in verse 32. And when they approached Ahab with their request, he seemed to come out of a funk of sorts. He said, "You mean he's alive? Bring my brother to me." Now, Azamra's comment on that is pretty funny. It says, not funny, but salient. Ben-Hadad fled, but he knew as well as Israel's Arab adversaries would know until today that the Israelite heart is tender, merciful, and forgiving, and that he would only have to say a few soothing words, and the king against whom he had just unleashed two major wars in order to be able to enter into a peace process with him. Okay, so he's talking about entering into a peace process. Is this not what Israel does all the time now? They get into a war and then somebody steps in and they say, "Well, you know, we got to get this peace process going." And then Israel never does actually win. So anyway, this isn't necessarily what happened. It could have been that Ahab didn't want to go on having a war every year against Ben-Hadad, so he was amenable to being merciful or tolerant to him for the time being. Here he was with a very valiant army of 7,232. But that wasn't enough in his mind to keep the wolves at bay. Such a small force could possibly invite trouble hunters to try him out. Meanwhile, Ben-Hadad's household help, listening carefully to what Ahab said and trying to discern his attitude toward their boss, took Ahab's welcome of Ben-Hadad as a good omen and said that Ben-Hadad was indeed a brother to Ahab. So, in verse 33, they went and they fetched Ben-Hadad to Ahab, and when he approached, Ahab invited him into his chariot for a confab on Shalom. Ben-Hadad wasted no time, in verse 34, in making reparations with Ahab, proposing that he would restore the cities his father had taken from Israel, and that he would allow Ahab to control some of the markets in Damascus, in the same way his father had in Shomron.
All right, and we are at the break, so we'll pick it up there on our return.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. thousand years old. It's not
all right, MP, we are back, folks, the Torah Teachers Roundtable, and let's go right back to MP here in the last segment. I don't think he was quite finished.
Oh, yeah, I was had just finished on verse 34, and I'm ready to move on to 35 to 42.
Okay. Rob, how about you? Are you finished?
Well, if I can, you brought up an interesting point here, and... And I thought that it would be, let me just stop for a second. The Midrash writes that he who becomes compassionate to the cruel will ultimately become cruel to the compassionate in Kohelet Rabbah 7:36. And Maimonides adds in his book, The Guide to Perplexed, compassion towards the wicked is cruel to all human beings. Regarding the verse, in this is stemming from Shaul's war with Amalek, or Amalek, in 1 Samuel 15:9, and Shaul and the nation spared Agag. An interesting way it says, and this doesn't say as normally people say, that Shaul did it. It said Shaul and the nation spared Agag. Now the Midrash says, Rabbi Eliezer said, one who becomes compassionate to the cruel will ultimately become cruel to the compassionate, as it is written, and Shaul and the nation spared Agag and the best sheep and the cattle, as it is written in 1 Samuel.
I can kind of see that.
And
the nation was involved as well, not just the king.
That's what I'm saying. And it says, and ultimately, and Nob, the city of the priests, he smote with the edge of the sword. So, as we know, King Shaul was commanded by the prophet Samuel to go in to smite Amalek and confiscate all that is theirs in 1 Samuel 15:3. This commandment stemmed from the Torah commandment to erase the memory of Amalek. However, the hearts of Shaul and the nation had compassion on Agag, now the king of Amalek, and on the best of the cattle and the sheep. It resulted with Shaul refraining from completely fulfilling the Torah. Now, having said that, this isn't a moral message. It's a judicial principle, which our sages are articulating in this Midrash, that the principle is you have an obligation to obey Torah, especially the obligation of the government to obey Torah. So that's what's being alluded to here. The prophet isn't just prophesying. He's establishing Torah law. And so Ahav is breaking Torah law.
Right.
By not doing what Yahweh says. That's Torah. What Yahweh says is Torah.
Absolutely. So
by not doing Torah, you are... it's not a moral situation, it's a judicial situation. And I think we need to not lose sight of that, is that when Yahweh says something, you have to do it as a point of law.
That's right.
And when you don't do that, then you are on shaky ground. There is no law in the land. Now see, unlike most governments, Israel and Judah are operating fluidly with direct communication with Yahweh. And that's why he says that he made his law, made his word known to Jacob and his law to Israel. And he hasn't done so with any other nation. No other nation has this fluidity of direct communication. But at the same time, then, that means you have to obey Yahweh, or it becomes a point of law, that you have actually broken law. And I think that has to be stated clearly, and not equivocate from the fact that with Yahweh, when the prophet says, thus saith Yahweh, he's establishing a point of law. and you have to follow it. And that becomes uncomfortable for a king, because then he's not an absolute monarchy. He's a representative, he's a delegated representative. And this has always been the problem with the monarchy in Israel. Unlike the monarchies around them, they aren't technically absolute monarchs. They are only delegated authorities, much like Moses was.
Right.
Anyway, I just wanted to make sure we understood that point, is that because we had made that statement, usually that statement is made from a standpoint that it's a moral point that they're trying to make, but that's not what that statement is about. That statement is a point of law, and so much so, by the way, that in the Supreme Court rulings of Israel, today Israel, they allude to this point, this prophecy, as a point of law. Constantly. They did so when a treasurer embezzled money, so much money that it caused a national security problem. And there was a call to show mercy to him. And the Supreme Court came down with this: we can't be merciful to him because what he did compromised national security and endangered the nation. And so if we are compassionate to him, then we are jeopardizing national security. And right. So I think, and I just wanted to make that point, that this is not a moral issue. This is a judicial issue. What Ahab did, what Achav did, was put the national security of Israel in jeopardy. Amen. And so he has to die.
Okay.
As a traitor. Yep.
Interesting. Okay, absolutely. And you know, that's an interesting concept if you think about it, the idea that somebody who's a traitor and puts the national security at risk, I wonder where the founders got this idea of that being a death penalty as well, but it is.
Yeah. Well, it endangers everyone.
This is exactly where they got that.
I know. I was trying to be sarcastic because you know, it's a disgusting thing when we've come so far that most people don't even recognize anymore what the issues are that are being overlooked in the press and on TV. It just speaks volumes about what has happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Okay. And Pete, shall we, are we ready to move on?
I'm ready to move on.
Okay. So why don't you go ahead and read from where you think we stopped?
Okay. Well, I stopped at 34, so I'll read the rest of the chapter and then,
okay. Rob's talked about the cities, but go ahead and read from there.
Okay. Has he read the scripture yet?
I don't think so. No, I think he's just talked about it.
Okay. And a certain man of the sons of the prophets, gee, I wonder who that is, said unto his neighbor in the word of Jehovah, smite me, I pray thee. And the man refused to smite him. Then said he unto him, because thou hast not obeyed the voice of Jehovah, what were we just talking about? Behold, as soon as thou art departed from me, a lion shall slay thee. And as soon as he was departed from him, a lion found him and slew him. Then he found another man and said, smite me, I pray thee. And the man smote him, so that in smiting he wounded him. So the prophet departed and waited for the king by the way, and disguised himself with ashes upon his face. And as the king passed by, he cried unto the king and said, thy servant went out unto, that's, I'm talking about me. He says, thy servant went out into the midst of the battle, and behold, a man turned aside, and brought a man unto me and said, keep this man. If by any means he be missing, then shall thy life be his for his life, or else thou shalt pay a talent of silver. And as the servant was busy, thy servant was busy, here and there he was gone. And the king of Israel said unto him, so shall thy judgment be, thyself hast decided. And he hasted and took the ashes away from his face, And the king of Israel discerned him that he was one of the prophets, and said unto him, and he said unto him, thus saith Jehovah, because thou hast let go out of your hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore thy life shall go for his life, and thy people for his people. And the king of Israel went to his house heavy and displeased, and came to Samaria. Now, Micaiahu heard about the bargain that the kings had made and was not impressed, so he determined to illustrate Ahab's folly by way of an object lesson. Remember the 7,000 of the 7,232 were quite possibly the school of the prophets. And if that is the case, then Micaiahu approached his neighbor. That man was one of the other 6,999 prophets. Micaiahu had shown himself to be the chief prophet of this school of the prophets, perhaps behind only Eliyahu and Elisha in authority. Micaiahu was the senior prophet there, perhaps the headmaster of the school. So when he asked the first of his neighbors to please hit me in the word of Jehovah, it was tantamount to an order from Jehovah. It was like the commanding officer of a military passing on an order from the president to his troops. You don't have to have the option to disregard an order from the president, whether it comes from his own lips or from an authority between you and the president. To quote Oliver North, you just salute and take the hill. This first prophet didn't follow Jehovah's order. So, in verse 36, Micaiahu told him, as soon as you leave here, a lion is going to attack you and kill you. And sure enough, as soon as that disobedient prophet left Micaiahu, a lion pounced on him and killed him. Now, question. Do you suppose that this is the same lion that killed that prophet Iddo in chapter 13 and verse 24? I think. I'm sorry?
He might be an old lion by this point.
He would be an old lion, but still, it could be the same lion. Neither lion did anything more than kill the disobedient prophet. Back in 13:26, it says this, and when the prophet that brought him back from the way heard, he said, if the man of Elohim, who was disobedient unto the word of Jehovah, therefore Jehovah hath delivered him unto the lion, which hath torn him and slain him according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake through him. Now in verse 37, Micaiahu found another man and told him, hit me, please. This man did as he was told. The lion was right there standing over his kill and not eating it, by the way, probably, wounding Micaiahu, the second prophet did, who immediately, in verse 38, spread ashes and maybe some dust on his face to disguise himself from Ahab, who had seen him before and would recognize him otherwise. Now, as Ahab drove by in verse 39 and 40, the prophet told the king a story of himself that he knew on himself that he knew would bring proper judgment against him from the king. When the king pronounced righteous judgment against him, Micaiahu quickly rinsed the ashes and dust off in verse 41 and showed Ahab who he was and brought Jehovah's judgment against him, that is Ahab. Azamra has this on verse 42. It says, God had maneuvered Ben-Hadad into his trap in verse 42, but Ahab let the Aramaean king get away, much as recent Israeli governments have almost never lost an opportunity to allow the country's enemies to get away with their endless aggressions and provocations. That's the end of Azamra's quote on that. Thus says Jehovah, I set up your enemy for destruction, and you let him go. Therefore, I will have your life in his place, and I will remove the kingdom from you, and I will take your people instead of his people. Not only was the lion probably the same lion, but the judgment is also similar. The transgressor gets to pay the price for his disobedience. And so, Ahab went home to Shomron, disheartened, verse 43, that he had not followed through against Ben-Hadad. Now, I think Ben-Hadad will become a real thorn in Ahab and his family's and Israel's future, and we'll see that in the next chapter. That's what I've got on this chapter.
Okay, well, just one other quick comment, because I don't think it was obvious, and it's one of those things that once you see it, it makes sense. When you first read this, and you got all these people saying, hey, whack me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But the commentaries note that after, you know, the second or third time we see this, the reason for the strange command becomes clear, because the prophet is essentially positioning himself, literally putting some beating on himself so that he looks like a soldier who suffered the wounds and bruises of battle. And this is part of his rebuke to Ahab that when he sees it, maybe it'll be a little bit more clear. And that, in that context, I like it. It makes some good sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It makes good sense. Yeah. What you got, Rob?
Well, Mikiyahu, a member of the school of the prophets, said to another one, "By the word of Yahweh, hit me." But the man refused to hit him. Then he said to him, "Because you didn't listen to the voice of Yahweh, the moment you leave me, a lion will kill you." No sooner had he left than a lion found him and killed him. So this sign was bad for Ahab, for the prophet said to him by the word of Yahweh to kill Ben-Hadad, and he didn't kill him. Also, this one to whom the prophet said by the word of Yahweh, the Holy One, blessed be he said that you shall strike me, so hit me. And he didn't strike him. Just as he punished him, he would punish Ahab. The prophet went to another man and said, hit me. And the man struck him a blow and wounded him. Now, it's interesting. The word there is patsah. This wounded him, patsah, meaning to split. To split. He struck him.
Patsah, to explode, kind of.
He struck him and ruptured the skin. He didn't just bruise him. Now, Jonathan, the Hebrew word there is bay afar, but Jonathan renders it as bay ma'afar, which means had to put on a head bandage, wrap it around the head. It's a bandage. In Hebrew, it's a bandage, but from what Jonathan renders, it was a head bandage. Now, this is interesting. Because the prophet left and waited for the king by the road, disguising himself with a bandage over his eyes. So he changed his head bandage so that you couldn't recognize him. Any change of bandage here is an expression of disguise. And as the king passed by, he called out to the king and said, "Your servant was on his way into the thick of the fighting when someone turned from the road to me and brought a man, a prisoner of war, to me and said, 'Guard this man. If he's missing, runs away. If he's missing and he runs away, you will pay for his life with yours, or else you will pay 66 pounds of silver, either your life or the talent of silver. But while your servant was busy with one thing and another, he disappeared.' The king of Israel said to him, 'So that is your sentence. You have pronounced it yourself.' King Ahab was obviously frustrated with the prophet's cryptic message. He said, 'What are you getting at? If I take you literally, you know what to do. Pay the fine of the talent of silver or turn yourself in to be executed.' Suddenly, Mikiyahu removed the bandage from his eyes, and the king of Israel recognized him as Mikiyahu, one of the prophets. This was an aha moment. Then Mikiyahu said to King Ahab, 'Here is what Yahweh says.'" And I imagine Ahab is getting tired of that phrase. "Because you have let escape the man I have given over to you to be destroyed, the man of my war." The word there is Aisha Harama. The man of my war. An expression of strife, naturally, with Yahweh. Now the expression fits the war. Similarly, in Isaiah 34:5, "On Edom it will descend, and on the nation with whom I war." Thus, the rendering is "the man with whom I war." According to the Midrash Agadah, "many traps and nets have been spread over you until he fell into your hands." So, this, what the Midrash is saying is that this has gone on long enough, and Yahweh had put the king of Aram into the hands of Ahab to do a death blow to whom Yahweh was having war with. And if you remember, as we began this chapter, they were making statements of untruth towards Yahweh. And Yahweh cannot let that stand. He's not the God of the mountains only. He is the supreme deity of all there is none besides him. And so because of that, he has put the king of Aram into the hands of Akav for Akav to kill and to honor the name of Yahweh. Now because you interfered with my judgment, you'll pay with your life for his life and with your people for his people. King Akav knew he had crossed a line. Was it a point of no return? The king of Israel returned home to Shimron, resentful and depressed. His spirit turned away from him, it says. It means that he became severely depressed. So this situation is grieving him. So we'll see, does he make teshuvah? Does he make this a national point of teshuvah? Turn the country around? And begin to live a righteous life? Or does he continue this downward spin? That's what we'll see in the next chapter.
All right. Okay, anything else? We've actually got just a couple of minutes left in the entire show, so it's almost probably not good to head into 21 until next week. But I'll say it this way. Final comments, MP? Anything on the story here? Mark? Did we lose him again?
Here we go. Yeah, he didn't lose me. I just had my mic shut off. I've got a cough, so I'm trying to not
interrupt you. I thought you might be just kind of thinking about all the wonderful statements of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She speaks so eloquently.
Okay, well, you know, I hate to end on that note for crying.
You're closer to him than I am, Mark. Just reach out and smack that guy.
Okay.
Well, I said that for a point. Is that
I was hoping so, because I can't imagine any other reason for saying that.
In the next passage, we're going to see a nut, a female, that, and I don't mean that as a misogynist term, but we see a female coming in, making stupid advice to King Akav, much like we're getting this advice from this junior congressman, and I use the term junior in an exclamated underlined fashion.
Right.
And if we listen to her as a nation, it's going to be like Akav and the nation of Israel listening to Jezebel, for she does definitely have a Jezebel spirit.
Jezebel is smarter than the person we're talking about personally, more evil and more able. But nevertheless, you make a good point, Rob.
Well, I don't know if she's more evil. Definitely more able.
Well, I think it behooves us to see the depravity with which that part of the house will go down to. But definitely.
Well, sorry, Rob, but that definitely takes us to the top of the hour. We'll pick it up there from the beginning of chapter 21 next week. Thanks, folks. Thanks, guys. Shalom.